dealing now with verse 17. Here as we get another angelic announcement that will, one of many that we've seen throughout Daniel's 70th week, as this angel, and I saw an angel standing in the sun. And he cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in mid-heaven, come, assemble for the great supper of God. And as a connective chi here, I saw, this is a pretty standard way John introduces eidon, is the verb to see. John introduces a shift in either subject matter or chronology or something here. Here a shift in subject matter, backing up now pre-Second Advent proper. This chronologically occurs before the Second Advent. And I saw an angel. Literally, you've got the numeral heis, one angel, is angelos. A-G-G-E-L-O-S. And under Greek rules of pronunciation, when you have two hard consonants, gammas, the first one's pronounced like an N. And I saw an angel standing, perfect active participle of histemi, the verb to stand, in the sun. Preposition N with the locative of halios, the definite article as well. And he cried out. This word, kradzo, means to scream, to cry, to yell. It has an idea of a lot of audio here. He cried out in a great voice, when we deal with voices or sounds, and you have the adjective as you do here, megas, you translate it loud. He cried out with a phoné voice, loud, megas, saying, present active participle of lego, to all the birds. You got the dative here of the adjective pos, all. The birds is the definite article plus ornion. An ornithologist, as you know, is one who studies birds. So that word has a Greek root, as you might imagine, as so many of words in our language do. The ones flying is pedomai. You got a present participle. The ones flying in the mid-heaven. This word is an N with a locative here of mesuranema. M-E-S-O-U-R-A-N-E-M-A. That word is a compound from uranos here, which means heaven, and mesos in the middle or in the midst. The ones flying in the mid-heaven. Then you have this word here. It's actually an adverb, but it can be used as an imperative, duro, D-E-U-R-O. It's an adverb of place. It means here, but it can be used as an imperative, come here, as the idea of it, get here. So they just translate it here with the simple come. Come, assemble. And then here you do have an aorist active, or an aorist passive imperative, literally, of sunago. S-U-N-A-G-O. This actually means to go somewhere, and then soon means with. Passively, it means to assemble or come together. And that, we do have a passive here. Come, assemble for the great supper of God. For is actually the directional preposition ice here, into, and it indicates not just that you get there, but that you participate in it, is the idea here. Assemble for the supper. Deipnon, D-E-I-P-N-O-N, with the definite article, is the noun, accusative, neuter, singular. This is the major meal of the day. They had a different word which meant like a brunch, like what we would normally say is lunch. But in the ancient cultures, they had largely two meals. One was a lesser meal, and then one was the primary meal of the day. And for us, we would say supper, because that is, in our culture, primarily, supper is the big meal of the day. So come assemble for the supper, the great one. Megas, again, the adjective of God, genitive here, a subjective genitive, theos, God is doing the providing of the supper. It's God's supper. A subjective means the noun, and the genitive is performing the action. God's giving this supper. In order that you may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of commanders, and the flesh of mighty men, and the flesh of horses, and of those who sit on them, and the flesh of all men, both free men, slaves, and small and great. In order that is a conjunction here, hina, which introduces a purpose clause, so that you may eat. You have an aorist active subjunctive of the verb to eat, estio, E-S-T-H-I-O. So that you may eat flesh. This word means sarx. It refers to what covers your body. It's the musculature that covers your frame. And not just the outside, not just the epidermis, but all of you. Here, the flesh and everything on the body, outside of the bones, we might say. The flesh of kings, basileus, and the flesh, sarx is repeated throughout it. You probably can see that in the English translation. The emphasis here is on flesh. Lots and lots of flesh. Lots and lots of dead flesh, in fact, is really what we're looking at. These are people who are going to be the casualties of war. And the birds are assembled. This is a part of God's big cleanup. And they have to be assembled before the war so that once the war is over, which won't last long, there's no indication that the second advent and Armageddon as we know it lasts very long once the Lord arrives. The slaughter's pretty quick. So you may eat the flesh of the Chiliarchos, C-H-I-L-I-A-R-C-H-O-S. This means literally the ruler of 1,000. Arche means to be number one or to be a ruler, and Chilios, our word millennium comes from that, is the word for 1,000. So here they translate it by the term commanders. These were the chief military men. We might say the generals if we speak in our current military terms. The highest mucky mucks. So one of the things we saw is that at the end of this thing, and even beginning into the middle of Daniel's 70th week, God levels the playing field big time. That the rich and the powerful and the elite and the mighty men of war and all of that are brought down to the same level as the slaves, of those who are insignificant and inconsequential. You saw it back beginning in chapter 6 even, with the opening of those seals. And I think it was the sixth seal, chapter 6, verse 15. And the kings of the earth, and the great men and the commanders, that's our term there, Chiliarchos, and the rich and the strong, and every slave and every free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. And so God starts to level the playing field, both in a human sense, but also he's going to level the entire earth. That all the mountains are going to be gone, everything's going to be flattened. And so this is a part of that, that in this big battle, it won't matter how rich you were, it won't matter how strong you were, it won't matter anything. You're going to end up just like the other dead people. So you've got the Chiliarchos, the commanders, the flesh of mighty men is Iskuros, I-S-C-H-U-R-O-S, means exactly that, strong or mighty. And the flesh of hippos, horses, and the one sitting on them. As we pointed out here, in every battle, you get to a point where one of the problems becomes, of course, they're fighting here now for supremacy of planet Earth as they assemble for this final battle. They're not really assembling, as it were, to fight against the Lord. They will fight against the Lord, there's no doubt about that. But that was not their original purpose. Their original purpose is to see who's going to rule the planet. We know the kings from the east come in with their army, an incomprehensible army, in fact. We haven't seen anything like it ever assembled on the planet to this point. And they have this tremendous army that they have to move from China, regions around there, Korea, Vietnam, and those are at that area. This is going to have to be mobilized and moved to the Middle East. And I would assume they're going to use every mode of transport they got. Some of them will go by ship. Some of them will go by aircraft carrier and all that. And some of them are going to move along the land. And the ones going along through the land may be withstood by other nations, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, those nations that are in the way. And so there's going to be a lot of casualties there just on the initial ascent or descent into those plains of Israel. And you got Russia, who is retooled after a massive defeat on the mountains of Israel. Some 3.5 years later, what's left of their military is going to come. But with all the destruction of the world that's been going on, and we do know that you've got problems with the environment, they have not calculated, and of course there's no real way to calculate. You cannot calculate the effects of a nuclear destruction, the likes of which that we're looking at coming into the Western Hemisphere. So the entire Western Hemisphere, for all practical purposes, is null and void. The United States is taken out. They're gone. We're gone. And then, of course, all the fallout from this, as we know, takes several months. But given the nature of the Gulf Stream and the way the oceans work, that the oceans are going to be contaminated initially from this after a period of months to the degree of a third of the oceans. A third of the green plants are going to be affected. This is going to make a huge, as we've pointed out already, huge changes in the environment. Because everything is based, a lot of our oxygen comes from photosynthesis. And if photosynthesis is destroyed, oxygen levels are going to drop. And then you have an increase in carbon dioxide. They're worried about the ozone layer. That's going to be the least of their problems. And as we pointed out, this is going to affect machinery. Engines are going to have trouble because you're talking about a deal now where they don't have proper oxygen to operate and combust. So we saw that a third of the ships are going to be disabled. They don't have to be destroyed. But again, they've not calculated, and nor could you, the impact of a 5,000 megaton nuclear strike. And a megaton, again, is equivalent to 1 million tons of TNT. And we're talking about 5,000 million tons of TNT exploding. And we're talking about the expelling of a tremendous amount of land mass from the planet. So much so that we know that the overall effect is the increased speed of the rotation of the Earth will be revved up by about a third. And so that's going to cause a shortening of the day-night cycle. And how is that going to affect people? Literally, as we saw as we got down to the end of this, people are got to be going nuts. I mean, the world is in a state of absolute chaos. But given what we know of human nature and the men in charge, somebody wants to control all this chaos. Somebody wants to rule over it. And so you have Antichrist, who ultimately, Satan is, his goal has always been to take control of this planet and have the worship of both men and angels. Now, that's going to be his goal. And so as he is confined at the middle of Daniel's 70th week and ejected from the third heaven by Michael, we saw that Michael instigates a warfare against Satan and ejects him. Michael kicks him out. Satan's confined to planet Earth. Well, because he is not omnipotent, he's not God, he's not omnipresent, he's a finite creature. And he's got to be confined to one space. Well, that space he chooses is Antichrist. And he inhabits Antichrist. And so he's got not only the insanity of Antichrist in his human mind to deal with, but the insanity of Satan now is incorporated into this person. And his desire is to rule the planet. Well, everybody on the world is not, you know, as a certain nations and all, will not just lay down for this. And so as they assemble here, the idea is they're getting together to find out who's going to rule what's left. Who's going to be in charge of it? And at a certain point, conventional warfare is the only way to solve this. All the technology at a certain point becomes, as we know, in any battle, if you really are battling for supremacy, it's going to come down to hand-to-hand combat at some point. And that's literally what you have here. That's why you have so many dead people. They're not going to be shooting nukes into the middle of Israel. They can't do that. And who knows? Again, Russia has largely, if not completely, I think they will have completely decimated their nuclear strike capabilities. They won't have any. But will there be limited nuclear exchanges during this time? Probably so. But not that I found in Revelation, but common sense and what I know of the human race tells me that there probably will be. These people don't have weapons. And one of the things we know from history, there has never been an army assembled. There has never been a military machine assembled that has not been used. It's all there for a reason. And so I've got to believe that given human nature, they're going to use everything at their disposal. Comes a point, you've exhausted all your technology, and it boils down to hand-to-hand combat. And you're just going to have to go fight it out and see who wins. You would think the Chinese, or that confederation, it's actually going to be a four-nation confederation, we know. I assume China will head it up, the kings of the East. They've got the manpower to win this thing just by sheer wearing them out. I mean, you can just throw wave after wave of soldiers at people till you just finally overrun them. I mean, if you can field a million-man army, or a 200-million-man army, actually, as it's stated there, if you can field that kind of army just through sheer erosion, you're going to be able to take over. So you're talking tremendous numbers of people moving into this place, into this stage area. And we've got all these, the flesh of all men, both those who sit on them, the horses. And I don't take this to be tanks, per se. I mean, you've got some, surely they'll have mechanized infantry and all that in there, but the reality is, at a certain point, now you get back to the real fundamental nature of warfare. It's me against you. It's one king and his army against another king and his army. And the armies ultimately have to fight it out. And at a certain point, you get down here to the end, and it looks like to me this is just very much what you would expect in terms of conventional warfare. So, as we know, and another thing, too, if you know anything about the current state of affairs, the Chinese, and particularly the other nations over there in the Far East, their military is well behind and well inferior in terms of what they've got to what other nations at this point. They're tooling up. They're trying to modernize it, but it's still behind the times, we might say. But again, if you can field a 200 million man army, how much artillery do you need? And these people are just viewed, as you know, in terms of warfare, they're just viewed as human sacrifices. I mean, the general has no qualms about ordering, send this wave in, then send this one in, then send this one in. And you just overwhelm them, erode them away. So you got the flesh here of all men here, and the horses and one sitting on them, and the flesh of all. Again, you got the adjective pos. Then you have this little connected particle that serves here. It goes with chi. And it usually is translated by the phrase both, and that's how they've translated, or the term both. Both free men is eleutheros, E-L-E-U-T-H-E-R-O-S. This means people with the right of self-determination. Now, all people have that, but one of the things, one of the lies that's perpetrated on our society and the world at large is that slavery doesn't exist. Oh, it still exists. Don't kid yourself. And as we pointed out, slavery as an institution is neither good nor bad. It is simply an institution. It can be used wrong. It can be used right. It's like guns. Guns are neither good nor bad. They're morally neutral. You can use them for good things. You can use them for bad things. So here you've got free men, politically and socially free, and slaves, doulos. There are people, I would assume, in this battle that are there because they want to be. And then there are people that have been conscripted. They're there against their will. They're just slaves. They're just pawns in this big deal. And you know, of course, when the battle comes, they're the first ones that are sacrificed. So you got the free men and slaves, small, mikros. We get our word micron from this, M-I-K-R-O-S. Small and great, megas. Again, small, that which is insignificant politically, socially, that which the world does not look at and take any real thought about. And then the great ones, the celebrities, the important people. The ones the world tells us are important. Who is important? Well, it's whoever the world says it's important. That's not really true from a doctrinal standpoint, but that's the way society and culture is. Who's important right now? Who's hot? Who cares? Who's going to be the next American Idol? I don't know. I don't care. And so you have in society, you have people that are looked up to as, oh, they're great. Why? They made a movie. Yeah, that's my definition of greatness. You starred in a movie. No, not really. They're great. They won an Olympic gold medal. Well, that's good. I'm happy for them. Doesn't make them great. So you got that type of people. So all these groups, again, this whole phrase here is designed to be inclusive of everybody that's present there. So one, John now begins a new section, as he has done so many times in this book, with the phrase, Chi Idon, and I saw. Two, the vision shifts from the returning warrior Messiah to the armies that will be arrayed against him at the second advent. Three, the second and third visuals of this chapter concern themselves with the eschatological war. Eschatology, of course, is the study of the last things. This is, again, from the human perspective, they might say, the war to end all wars. Of course, that was supposed to be World War I, wasn't it? No, it turned out it wasn't. We haven't ended war at all. War is big business, let's face it. So this has been predicted previously in Revelation 16, 16. And they gathered them together to the place, which in Hebrew is called Harmagedon, or Mount. That's a Hebrew. Har means mountain. The Mount of Magadan. And verse 14 also here, as we saw these demonic forces that are present in the world today. Our nation's loaded with them. The unseen fight that goes on behind the scenes. The angelic conflict. Our nation has become the dwelling place of every unclean and hated spirit. All the things you see in society is not just the normal decay or stupidity of the human race. Some of it is flat out demonic. And some people, you know, they make no secrets about it, whereas others are more subtle about it. But demons are out there, the war behind the scenes. We live in the covert, intensified stage right now. The battle is heating up in the heavenlies. The battle is heating up all around. We don't see it. All we can do is sense it, and we see the inevitable decay of society. And a lot of this is tied to demon activity. And so what do? We're a nation that medicates demons with Prozac. Well, it doesn't help them. They're still demons. You might calm them down with some lithium, but you're not going to fix the problem if they're demon-possessed. And again, ancient cultures were in some way more sophisticated about this than we are, because the reality is they view everything today as a physical problem. Everything is a disease. You used to have heartburn. Now you got acid reflux disease. You used to have, you know, this or that, but now it's a disease. Everything is not a disease. But, again, we're into this because there's big, big bucks to be made in pharmaceuticals. And if you think the drug companies aren't into big bucks, you've missed the point. So you can't medicate away demon problems. It'd be nice if we could, but you can't. And so these demons go forth, as we see here. These are the spirits of demons, these three unclean spirits like frogs, a filthy, disgusting idea here of the frogs coming out of his mouth. And these are demonic spirits performing signs. As we have pointed out, we live in the covert, intensified stage where we don't see what's going on right now prior to the rapture. We don't see all the fights in the heavenlies. We don't see the angels and demons dealing with what they're dealing with. But as you get into Daniel's 70th week, that last 7 years, as we pointed out, this becomes very supernatural very fast. First, you have these angels flying around making these announcements at the beginning. You have the rapture that you have to explain. You have the appearance of Antichrist, a man alive from the dead. How is this going to be explained? You have all, and he's able to do miracles, and the false prophet is able to do miracles in his presence. And they can call fire down from heaven. And then you've got the two witnesses, Moses and Elijah, who reappear. And they're doing miracles over there, killing their enemies, smiting the lands with plagues, and doing various things. And so this goes overt very fast here. Right now it's covert. It's hidden. We don't see it. But it's happening all around us, trust me. The angelic conflict is alive and well. And it is heating up. And it's going to continue to escalate. But here, it all goes over. And everybody's able to see this difference. That doesn't mean they'll be able to see demons per se. But you're going to see a lot of miracles, a lot of supernatural activity. And people are going to have to make a decision. This forces them to make a decision when you can see it. And you get all these warnings here. So these three frog demons come out, and they go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty. And God has arranged all this. Again, everything's in place. And in all this plan, of course, he still allows for the free function of volition. These people are doing this stuff because they want to. They're doing it because this is what they want to pursue. So for we know from that passage that demonic spirits have been inciting the negative leadership of the nations of the world, goading them into a war. Five, this eschatological war has many biblical and mythological antecedents. There has been much written about a final cosmic battle between God and Satan. Six, the forces of good are pitted against the forces of evil for one final battle, in which good triumphs and evil is destroyed. Seven, John now observes a single angel using a construction, literally one angel, that he has used only one other time in this book. He used it in Revelation chapter 18. on the situation here where the angel gives an object lesson about the destruction of Babylon. And one angel, literally one strong angel, it says in the Greek, took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea. So six, this angel was observed standing in the sun, now, which has raised the question as to whether or not he was located physically on or in the sun, or if he was simply standing in the visible rays. Nine, in either case, the sight was no doubt impressive. This clearly points out that angels, factors like the sun, heat, cold, all of that, angels existed prior to the creation of any material thing. The order of creation was God, angels, universe, and man. And so God created all these creatures. Well, angels don't require a physical world in which to live. They are spirits, some sort of form of higher energy, probably in the order of some form of higher light that we don't understand. And they're not bound by time, space. They're not bound by dimensional realities. They can transcend dimensions and appear and disappear and do all kinds of. They can take human form if the plan of God calls for it. Not permanently. They can't incarnate, but they can appear as humans. So, and they come and go. They're not bound, you know, to any one particular spot. They're free and they move about, and they all each have their own volition. And so here you have this angel who's quite impressive, no doubt. But if he's standing on the surface of the sun, it's even more impressive. And apparently you can see him quite well. That's another whole deal about these announcements. They're designed to be quite visible and quite well heard. Nine, in either case, the sight was no doubt impressive. And his position is designed to offer maximum visibility as he makes his announcement. Ten, as has been the case, the use of the perfect tense standing here has the force of taking a stand for a purpose, to position oneself for a particular reason. And sometimes they'll even translate it that way when you see the perfect tense. Again, the idea of the perfect tense in the Greek is action in past time with existing results. He positioned himself there, and he's still standing there, we might say. So he's standing there for a purpose. 11, this angel has a message to deliver to some of God's creation, which he does in a loud voice that is capable of being heard by the intended audience. 12, this is another clear biblical evidence that God retains control over his creation at all times. The animal kingdom is subservient to his will. 1 Kings 17 gives an idea of this. But animals, weather, all these things, God controls all this. Nothing happens apart from his directive or permissive will. And he permits a lot of things. One of the things he permits is every creature to exercise their volition as they see fit. He has to force some limitations on Satan and his demons, otherwise they just destroy everything. But you can't you can't resolve the issues of the angelic conflict. As Satan is out on his appeal, we understand this, that in the course of any, say, real legitimate trial, and there's a sentence passed and an appeal is filed, you might allow the prisoner, the condemned, some measure of freedom in the meantime, you know, through the bail system and all that. But it doesn't mean he's free to just do anything. So Satan is limited in some ways, otherwise he'd just destroy and kill everybody. But he can't do that. God doesn't let him do that. So 1 Kings here, 17, 1 through 6. Now Elijah the Tishbite was one of the settlers of Gilead and said to Ahab, as the Lord of Israel lives, before whom I stand, surely there shall be neither dew nor rain any of these years except by my word. And the word of the Lord came to him saying, get away from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. And it shall be that that you shall drink of the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to provide for you there. So he went and did according to the word of the Lord, and he lived by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening. And he would drink from the brook. And so if God can do that, he has no trouble controlling all the rest of his creation. He controls the birds and the animals and everything else. And after a while, of course, the brook dries up because there's no rain. But there's no rain because Elijah, as the man of God, as per God's will, had spoken drought. And drought it was. And it didn't rain until Elijah said it was going to rain again. And so God clearly can work through people. He controls the elements. He controls the animals. These things are not a problem for him. It was manifested, say, in the life of Christ when he was on the planet. As he was on the sea, they were out there tossing, 20-foot waves, freaking out. And, he gets a peace, be still. And the wind and the waves stop. So he controls all of this. He winds up the hurricane and he throws it. And where it goes, well, we can plot the course, but that's about all we can do. Run from it if it's real bad. But God's protected us and will continue to do so. He knows where his people are. So here there is clear biblical evidence. This is another one that God retains it. 13, Jesus Christ manifested complete control over the physical creation at the first advent, which will be manifested in an even greater way during Daniel's 70th week and into the millennium. That's the Matthew 8 passage there that I was alluding to when he's in the boat. And they're all freaking out. He's down there asleep. Why? Because he's tired. And I mean, really, if there's a bad storm, I'd just soon sleep through it. I don't have to be awake for everything. So a great storm on the sea, verse 24, so that the boat was covered with the waves. And he himself was asleep. And if you've ever been out, very far where you couldn't see land in really squally weather, it can get pretty spooky pretty fast. And they woke him up, "Save us, Lord, we are perishing." And he said to them, "Why are you timid, you men of little faith?" And he arose and rebuked the winds of the sea, and it became perfectly calm. And I'm not talking, this didn't take 5-10 minutes to do. I mean, he said still, and it was still. I mean, suddenly, from 20-foot seas, you go to a glassy surface. And that's pretty impressive. I mean, he did, obviously, a number of impressive things during the first advent, but that was one of the more. 14, the angelic command is issued to a specific portion of the animal kingdom. All the birds, the ones flying in the mid-heaven. 15, the Greek term ornion is used only 3 times, all in Revelation, by the way, and focuses on the types of birds that are unclean. Carrion birds that are noted for soaring high into the heavens and for eating flesh. We all know what vultures are like. If you've ever seen them, the buzzards, I mean, they're gross. You don't want to get close to them. They're nasty. They're filthy. And this is the segment of the birds he's talking to here. 16, the command is comprised of a command to come or come here, and an imperative of the verb sunago, which means to come together or assemble. 17, ironically enough, the same verb was used to express the purpose of the 3 frog demons, which go out to the kings of the whole world. We saw that in chapter 16, verse 14. 18, as has been noted by a number of interpreters, the message is gruesome and powerful, emphasizing that before the battle has actually commenced, the end result is certain. These birds are not being assembled for no purpose. There is going to be a tremendous amount of food for them to gorge themselves on. 19, these carrion birds are commanded to assemble for the purpose of attending the great supper of God. And 20, the contrast between this supper and the wedding feast is the fact that the saints are invited to feast with the Lamb, while the birds are commanded to assemble to feast on the enemies of God. And this is where they will end up. At least the military enemies will end up at this great slaughter and become flesh, become food. What's for lunch? The armies of the world. And they'll have them. 21 here, the genitive theos, and the reason we draw this contrast with the wedding supper is because it uses the very same word there for the idea of a supper. The wedding feast involved, as we know in the reception phase of it, or the marriage feast phase of it, following the wedding proper, there was this extended period of celebration, which was characterized by these great foods that were present. Well, here the food is the enemies of God. So to 31, the genitive of theos should be taken in a subjective sense. It is the tremendous supper that God provides for the assembled vultures. The supper of God that God provides, that God assembles for you. 22, it is qualified by the adjective megas, which is designed to focus on the extensive slaughter that will provide such a lavish feast for the birds. And 23, Robertson, in his Greek grammar, describes this as a bold and powerful picture of the battlefield after the victory of Messiah, while Sweet describes the scene as a sacrificial feast spread on God's table for all the vultures of the sky. And so God takes care of it. And that was one of the things that Jesus taught at the first Advent about, you know, the issues of fear and worry and things like that. God takes care of the birds. And the birds have plenty to eat, and they don't work. This is not a verse to teach you not to work, but it's a verse to teach you to faith rest things. I don't have to stand around worrying all the time, am I going to have enough? Will we have enough food tomorrow? No, God takes care of the birds. He's got to take care of me. He's got more at stake with me than he does with birds. I mean, I'm at least a moral creature. So God looks out for his people. He provides for them at all points. And we call that living grace. Well, here they get more than just living grace. They get a tremendous party here. Can you imagine if you're a vulture and you got all this slaughtered meat in front of you? I mean, you'd be in hog heaven or vulture heaven. maybe the vultures, this is heaven for them. As close as they get. So 24 verse 18 actually provides the grammatical reason for the call to assemble, which is found in the purpose clause introduced by Hina. 25, while the term flesh can be used in a number of ways in the Bible, here it focuses on the actual flesh as the muscular portion that covers the bones of a human or animal body. And 26, however, vultures are not picky and will consume every portion of the feast they are provided. They will eat the flesh, sinew, fat, etc. Now, they're going to pick the bones clean is sort of the idea behind this. There will not be anything left when they finish. 27, these birds are assembled to begin the great cleanup that must occur following Daniel's 70th week. That's their first and primary purpose for being here, is to clean this mess up in some ways. 28, the term flesh is repeated some five times in this verse. And actually, each time I didn't point that out in the exegesis, but in each time it's always a plural. It's flesh us. It's always the word sarx is a feminine plural. Five times in this verse to draw attention to the fact that these birds will be eating various pieces of flesh from the menu that God provides. 29, these categories will include, on the menu, who's going to be, what are we having tonight? Well, let's have some kings. A, those that occupied the highest place of leadership in a nation or confederacy. I don't know what they'll call the Antichrist as he heads up the EU over there. I think they call him a president, but as it stands right now, the president of the EU is largely a figurehead position. It doesn't really have a lot of power, and they turn it over. But they're exploring. I think he only serves for, it's a limited time. And I think they're exploring, giving the king, actually, their president, more and more power and a longer term is what the EU is looking at. So whatever they will call, whoever heads up that confederation, and then kings and leaders of countries, all that. B, commanders, literally those that commanded 1,000 soldiers, equivalent today to a general, colonel, or major, a high-ranking military official that commands a lot of people. It doesn't have to be literally exactly 1,000. That was just the Roman, during that time, they commanded specifically 1,000 soldiers. See, mighty men is the designation that denotes their military prowess and the physical capabilities in combat. Some people, as you know, are better soldiers than other people are. Some people are more, they're what we would call some people that are just natural born killers. They were bred for this almost. They can fight. They're good at what they do. And they're the kind of people you want in the military. You have these people, and even among the ranks, there are some soldiers that are stronger than others. Here you have the mighty men. And D, horses are to be taken literally here and not just as a mode of transportation, since all battles eventually must be climaxed in a hand-to-hand manner. And that's really what we get into at Armageddon. They've assembled for the one final big fight. Hand-to-hand, who's winner take all. That's at least the purpose for assembling. Winner take the earth, and you can have what's left. E, the ones sitting on them refer to their actual riders. F, the fleshes of all are designed to be a catch-all phrase that is defined more fully by the subcategories that follow. 1, free men are those that have political and social freedom that allow them to do as they will. Not everybody enjoys that in the world today. Not everybody can just come and go as they please. We have a large measure of freedom in this country that other people in other parts of the world don't have. You can't just do. go and do as you see fit. Two slaves refer to those that are subject socially or politically to another, those who serve in obedience to the will of another. Three, no doubt the free men came to this battle of their own accord, while the slaves were most likely pressed into battle. So you got people that probably want to be there, we might say, and then people that they don't really want to be there, but they're there. They were forced, they're conscripted into this. Four, small people are those that are viewed as being insignificant in the big scheme of things, those that society deems to be of little consequence or worth. Five, great refers to those that the world see as some sort of a celebrity, those that have achieved some position, renown, or notoriety for themselves. And apparently, the idea here is that even in these military things, you have people that are more notorious, we might say, than other people. And other people that have not, you know, made such a name for themselves. They don't seem to be that significant. Just an ordinary average Joe, you might say. And then there are those, again, that people really look up to. So 30, the purpose of listing these groups is to stress the fact that no segment of humanity will be excluded from the slaughter if they are present at this battle. Why say all this in this way and then keep repeating it? To let you know that every segment is going to be represented there. And it won't matter how great you were, how powerful, how mighty, or how insignificant you were. If you're at this battle, you're going to die. And that's it. 30, the purpose of these, again, no segment will be exempted from the slaughter. 31, some have noticed that the language of our passage is similar to the languages of Ezekiel 39, 17 through 20, where the judgment against Gog is punctuated by an invitation to the birds and wild animals together for a feast. We actually have a couple of things for which Ezekiel here in 39 forms there's a prophecy with respect to this great battle, which begins really in Ezekiel 38, but this assembly of nations is summoned, Gog, in chapter 38, verse 2. Gog from the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him. I am against you, O Gog. And Gog is the leader of the country. Magog is his land. And he heads up this confederacy of nations that include Persia, which is modern Iran, Ethiopia, and Put, and with them with shield and helmet. Put is, I think if I remember right, tantamount to ancient Libya or modern Libya. Gomer with all of its troops and Beth Togarmah. These were people that resided in the Asia Minor area around Turkey and north of there, up around the Black Sea. So there's this confederacy headed up by Gog. And Gog is the leader of Russia and all of that. So you've got this assembly drawn down. And then you have this prophecy about this great destruction on the mountains of Israel, that they're going to invade Israel, and that they're killed out there on the mountains of Israel in this fiery cataclysm. Done by God. He's going to rain fire on them. And so then you have this destruction that's mentioned in 39 here, verses 17 through 20. And as for you, son of man, speak to every kind of bird and to every beast of the field. Assemble and come together from every side to my sacrifice, which I am going to sacrifice for you, a great sacrifice on the mountains of Israel, that you may eat flesh and drink blood. And you may eat the flesh of mighty men and drink the blood of the princes of the earth as though they were rams, lambs, goats, and bulls, all of them fatlings of Bashan. So you will eat until you are glutted and drink blood until you are drunk. This is a great picture, isn't it? You ready for lunch? And from my sacrifice, which I have sacrificed for you, and you will be glutted at my table with horses and charioteers and mighty men and all the men of war, declares the Lord. Well, again, this forms a frame of reference. This refers to the initial destruction of Israel during Russia and its allies during Daniel's 70th week. However, the language in Revelation goes beyond just that group, because you've got the kings of the east and a bunch of other people that are not even mentioned in this passage. So what you have is, in the terms of prophecy, you have a dual fulfillment. And this is one of the principles of interpreting prophecies, that a prophecy can serve as a near frame of reference for something, and then have a more distant frame of reference. For instance, Judas is called the man of sin. He serves as a near frame of reference for the ultimate man of sin, Antichrist. Antiochus Epiphanes was viewed as a sort of type of Antichrist. But he only serves as the near frame of reference for the more distant fulfillment of the real Antichrist. Well, you have this destruction on the mountains of Israel just around or after the midpoint of Daniel's 70th week. And this serves as a frame of reference for another great feast that's going to occur right here. These aren't separated in terms of fulfillment far in time. But this forms the near fulfillment of it, and this forms the more distant fulfillment. Well, again, while this event forms the frame of reference for this incident, they do not appear to be detailing the exact same event. One, the command in our verses is issued by an angel, while that command is to be issued by Ezekiel. B, the beasts of the earth are included in Ezekiel, while they are not mentioned in our passage. And C, the slaughter in Ezekiel appears to be limited only to the military. While our passage, again, these are free men and slaves. It's not just military people that are killed in this war. It's much, much broader. All right, well, our time is up, so we will stop there and be ready to resume with verse 19 on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.